Before I introduce our speaker, I'd like to invite my fellow MFA students to imagine this pleasant fiction. You are 27 years old. You have your bachelor's degree from, say, West Virginia University. You've just completed your MFA. You've published 4 collections of short stories, but you know what they say, the 5th time's the charm. And it is. One reviewer blurbs your book by saying you, quote, display energy, artistic poise, and electric talent. By the way, that's Tim O'Brien. Another says, she's an original, and this book of hers is a crooked beauty. For the sake of this argument, let's call him Raven Carver. At a community college in Chicago and at colleges everywhere, young up-and-coming writers buy your book's poster and hang it on their walls for 9 years as inspiration for their first novels. But you're not done yet. You publish another collection, 5 novels after that. The president of ABC calls you up and asks, would you like the head writing position on a soap opera? And after some consideration, you're like, nah, I think I'll teach at Harvard instead. Or, no thank you, I think I'll establish the MFA program at Rutgers Newark. Or I think I'll go back to my home among the hills and inspire the next generation of young writers. Tonight, it is my great honor to introduce an author for whom this is no fiction. Please welcome Jane Ann Phillips.
That was a great introduction. And she really is sparkling. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Quiet Dell. I told the person who interviewed me that I was going to be sharing photographs from the book, but I promise you if you buy the book, there are photographs in it, as well as excerpts of newspaper stories of the day about the event on which Quiet Dell is based. So Quiet Dell is based on a 1931 serial murder. It was one of the first very, very celebrated crimes during the Depression, used at the time, as such stories still are, to distract people from the incredible problems going on in the Depression. This story was spun as a story, in a sense, to shame women. It was a story about why women should not venture out of their homes. This particular mystery man, who had at least 3 different aliases, was writing to over 200 women through what was called matrimonial agencies, clearly the precursor of our Match.com today. He put an ad in several different papers. These were called romance magazines. The trashier ones had names like Cupid's Arrow. The upper-class ones had names like the American Friendship Society. And it was through that society that he got in touch with one Mrs. Asta Eicher. These characters are all based on real people. I imagined their thoughts, their perceptions, even their relationships with one another, but I was using real photographs, real interviews, real information that I gleaned from newspaper accounts of the time. The story itself was so like a fairy tale once I began to really research it that I tried to sort of inject the book with a sense of that fairy tale through the imagination of the 9-year-old victim, Annabelle Eicher. This is very much a West Virginia story because Quiet Dell still exists near my hometown, Buchanan. People still live there. Some people have businesses there. It's only about 10 miles from Buchanan, and at the time that the story happened, there were only a few families living there. It was literally a hamlet of maybe 100, 200 people. The real names involved in the story, Asta Eicher, her children were Greta, who was 14, Hart, who was 12, and Annabelle, who was 9, almost 10. Their dog was named Duty, D-U-T-Y. the dog became very famous as the case came to light. The dog's picture ran in newspapers all over the country with the words, "Duty twice bereft," because in fact, the dog's first family had been wiped out by a tornado, and then the Eichers adopted him. He already had a name, his name couldn't be changed, he answered to duty, and in the book at least, Ast Eicher says, "His name will serve to instruct." As we are talking 1931, it was a very, very different world. As the case spun out in West Virginia, the lawyer was named J. Ed Law, who defended the accused. He had three names. In Clarksburg, West Virginia, where he'd lived for 4 years, he had married someone that he met through a matrimonial agency, a widow, and she became a kind of cover for him. The judge was named Judge Southern. The trial, everyone who was part of the trial stayed at the Gore Hotel, who of course is named for you-know-who, Al Gore's related family. The murderer went by, as I said, Harry Powers in Clarksburg. He was known as Cornelius Pearson to many of the women to whom he wrote, and by various other names. And his real name, I'm afraid that the reporter spilled that, but none of you read that, right? Because the mystery of who he really was and where he really came from, and the mystery even of his family, is a mystery that is answered in the book. So I'm going to just read snippets from various parts of the book that don't give away some of the book's secrets. Now, Annabelle, who is 9 years old, is, in a sense, a prescient child. She has what she calls dreams or fancies, and her mother worries because she feels that her daughter is much too fanciful. And then, in fact, her grandmother, who is the widowed mother's, the mother-in-law, they're living together trying to raise these three children after Asta's husband has died some 5 years before. So we're going to start on Christmas Eve in 1930 in Park Ridge, Illinois, home of the not-yet-born Hillary Clinton, I'm sure you know. But Park Ridge is a suburb of Chicago. So the story begins in Chicago, and it's a story about America at the time, really, because it moves from Chicago east to the Appalachians, back to the Midwest, all having to do with the wanderings of this mysterious figure, Harry Powers. So Christmas Eve, 1930, one more thing, the actual trial did take place in the local opera house. Every little town had an opera house. I remember when my hometown had an opera house. And there was once, I remember there being a circus there, and I actually saw an elephant on stage. It later became a movie theater, but at the time it was an opera house. The jail was being rebuilt, and so the trial was held in the opera house. And 1,200 people could fit in the opera house, and people stood in lines around the block to get into the trial those 3 days in December. The jury box was moved to the stage. The accused was walked on and off stage with a chain and dog collar. And it really did become, the entire orchestra was reserved for press, who came from all over the country to cover this case. Asta Eicher and Cornelius Vanderbilt wrote to one another for some 6 months, which was his typical plan. A lot of his letters, he had cribbed phrases from Rudy Valley's diaries. He made a lot of reference to his sainted mother and the spiritual nature of his parents' relationship. And he had a sort of code of phrases with which he progressed a relationship by letter. He never met the woman until right before they were about to be married. And Asta Eicher was a very respectable, very talented woman. She was a silversmith. Her family were originally from the Netherlands. So we'll start with her daughter, Annabelle. Christmas Eve, 1930, December 24th, Park Ridge, Illinois. Annabelle begins. Now, this is Annabelle's first-person voice. When the year turns, there are bells on the wind. All the old years fall on the ground in lights. When you walk across those lights, it sounds like walking on all the piled up leaves of giant trees. But up high, the bells are ringing for everyone alive. There are silver and gold and glass bells you can see through, and sleigh bells 100 years old. My grandmother said there was a whisper for each one dead that year, and a feather drifting for each one waiting to be born. My mother says that's just a story, but I always do hear the bells, even in my sleep, and everything in front of me is all white, open like a field. Then I start dreaming. The trees in my dreams sparkle. It's quiet in the dark, and I'm indoors on a stage. The trees are behind me, but they're alive, touching limbs and stir just so. A silent spirit seems to move among them, and the lights found me. It's a large theater, rows and rows, and a balcony I glimpse through the gleam. The audience is quiet, waiting for me to speak. Perhaps they're watching a play, my play, or a play in which I perform. I can't make out faces beyond the footlights, but I see the tilt of heads and the shapes of ladies' hats, and a glow seems to float amongst them. There's a hum of admiration or excitement, a swell of whisper like applause. Then the lights on the stage darken. I hear people weeping, so moved are they by the production. Grandmother used to say that I might find myself upon a stage one day as an actor or the author of a play. Judy is our Boston Terrier. It follows Hart everywhere and sleeps on our beds by turns, and Judy is in my dream. I stand on the stage before the trees, and Judy is there, sitting just at the edge of the light. His little legs are stubby, and his chest is broad, and his short brown coat shines like a mirror. Judy's eyes are wide apart, and he can seem to gaze in two directions, but he only looks off toward the wings, to where no one can see. Grandmother always told me that our dreams are wishes or fancies, gifts of the dream fairies that guide and care for us in our sleep. She said that poems and stories are the whisperings of angels we cannot see, beings once like you and me, who know more than we can know while we are here. Address me in your mind when I am gone, grandmother told me. I will hear you always and will send a reply in the sounds of the grass and the wind and other little signs. For we no longer speak in words when we have slipped away. I fed her with a teaspoon. She could not hold the cup. She talked about the silken cord that binds her soul to mine. She slept and woke and slept and woke. The cord is a real cord, and I keep it under my pillow. Not all of it. Once it was very long, the last of the silk braid Mother used on the sofa pillows. Grandmother made a game of it for walking through the park. We children went afternoons with grandmother, single file, holding to the cord. She used to say there was one of her and three of us. We children must hold to the cord just so. She fashioned one large knot for each right hand, and I was first behind her. We held to the cord in silence, for grandmother liked us to hear small sounds, the cricket and the mantis, grasses moving in the meadow. Sound travels even in the cord we hold, grandmother said, for the heart beats in the hand. You are not like others, grandmother liked to tell me. Your dreams see past us. The trees in my dream shine like trees on a glittery valentine. The sparkle looks like snow catching light or drops of rain held fast. It's a wonderful effect. Living trees could stand on a stage in pots of earth, and the limbs could move on wires, gently, as though stirred by a breath. Grandmother told me, when she was still up and sitting in her chair, that she would sleep longer and longer and then not wake up. She said her death would be a blessed death, the one she wished for me when I am very old. Grandmother can hear me. I do believe so, and I hear her voice in words that come to me. Perhaps she has sent me the dream about the trees. I could hear a sigh in the branches, a bare whisper. No doubt there was a fan off stage blowing a breath of motion. Grandmother used to say, so little can move so much. The first part of the book is really devoted to the family and to their beautiful Christmas, which is their last Christmas together. I'm just going to read the very beginning of a chapter or a section that's from Asta's point of view, from the mother's point of view. This is called Anna, Asta, Anna. Her pet name was Anna. This takes place Christmas Day, 1931. And as many people did, as my own mother's family did, people who were down on their luck, who had these beautiful old homes, often rented rooms to gentlemen roomers. And there was such a gentleman roomer whose name was Charles, and I first heard of him when I read a long letter that he wrote to the police in West Virginia, offering his rope with which to hang Harry Powers. But he lived with the family for some 4 years and had moved out because he was doing better. He was a man in his mid-30s whose home was broken up by death of his mother. So he was alone, he was an only child, and he became almost a part of the family and often returned for holidays. I won't say any more than that, but there's more to it in the book. So, Anna, Asta, Anna, Christmas Day, 1931, Parkridge, Illinois. Annabelle, darling, we simply can't have candles burning in rows across the living room carpet. You may mark off the stage with books, and the curtain will make a border for the stage. Asta, checking table settings, moved a water goblet slightly higher to the tip of the knife. Annabelle turned to regard her mother and said in a conversational tone, "The rooms where grandmother's gone are very dark." Why did she say such things? Asta touched her palm to Annabelle's forehead, no fever. She stroked her daughter's soft, tousled bangs and kept her tone even. Annabelle, your grandmother is surely in heaven, and heaven surely is not dark. Don't speak that way, and on Christmas, and before company. Asta looked at Charles, sitting companionably near her, his chair pushed back from the long table. I'm not company, Charles offered, but you should listen to your mother. Annabelle stood motionless, as though declaiming to them both. The rooms lead one to another down below. Outside there's a meadow full of sounds and creatures, crickets whirring, buzzing, and birds singing and clicking. It must be summer there, Charles said. Annabelle, that's enough. Asta pretended to consternation with the punch bowl. Go help your sister plate the figs and chocolates. She doesn't like me to help her with the settings. Nonsense, go on now, and Charles will be in shortly to help you with the theater curtain. Annabelle gave her mother a long look and turned on her heel. Goodness, that child. Asta watched her leave the dining room, touching a hand along the high back of every chair. Her short, dark hair, grown now to the nape of her neck, glimmered like a silken cap. Charles stood to help with a crystal bowl, holding it steady while Asta poured it full from pitchers of cream soda and seltzer. I must say I like the short haircut, very stylish. Has our Annabelle been reading about flappers and gin joints? No, but it does suit her. She didn't mention Annabelle's dramatic gesture. 2 days after Lavinia's funeral, she'd cut her braids off just at her ears and taken them in her pockets to lay atop her grandmother's grave at St. Luke's Cemetery, 3 blocks away. Charles had already left for the city and Asta had not sent word, lest he rush back when he'd already spent a week helping them. I'm putting out 6 cups, Charles. Annabelle will want one for Mrs. Pomeroy, who, just to prepare you, plays Lavinia in the pageant. Mrs. Pomeroy is her ragdoll. Our girl is fanciful, Charles said, and misses her grandmother. So that summer in July, Asta Eicher had her first meeting with Cornelius Vanderbilt, who drove to Chicago in his beautiful motor car. They went off to see his properties in the South. And if Asta found everything to her satisfaction, they would be married. The children were left with a nurse, Mrs. Abernathy. And now Cornelius Pearson, alias Powers, has returned to take the children to their mother in the South. In fact, their mother is gone. is already dead. But this section is called A Child's Journey, July 2nd, 1931, Park Ridge, Illinois. Annabelle was awake first and saw the black car parked below. She was sleeping in Greta's room, for the bed was large, and they both slept better so, with mother away. They wore beach pajamas. The nights were stifling, and they did as they liked after Abernathy shut her door at 8 p.m. It was Mr. Pearson's car, Annabelle was certain, shiny and clean as though it had never moved. "Greta, get up. The week is over, and mother's here. And Mr. Pearson, I'm going down." Greta was rubbing her eyes. "Should you? It's quite early. Mother's here. Abernathy will leave." Annabelle ran to wash her face. She must not say she was miserable. She quite liked Bible school, but Abernathy had been occupied all afternoon, polishing silverware and folding laundry, while Hart joined his friends at games and must be home by dinner. It was tiresome, for he took duty with him, and the girls hadn't even the diversion of going to the park. Duty returned parched and napped all evening and wandered disconsolate about the house until he found Annabelle's bed empty. She would hear the click of his nails along the hallway until she stood drowsily in Greta's doorway to announce herself. She would have to pick him up and lie down with her hand on him, or he would stand terrier fierce, pulling at her clothes, intent she go to her place. Her place was with mother in Mr. Pearson's automobile, gliding beside waterfalls and rivers. Greta was calling her. "Annabelle, shouldn't we put something on if Mr. Pearson is here? I'll choose you something, only hurry." They opened Greta's closet, in which mother stored the things she'd saved from grandmother's armoire. The dotted Swiss, the peach silk, the black lace. "This one," Annabelle said, and took the black. "But that's grandmother's mourning dress. It's for funerals. It's ever so pretty, though, with the cutout lace and the sleeves." Annabelle tossed her head. "Wear it for a robe, or wear what you want. I'm going down." She raced for the stairs, skipping every other one, duty at her heels. Rounding the landing, she slid a hand along the wide banister for balance and plummeted forward. "Good morning, my dear. You were awake early, and I'm so glad." He was standing just below her, instantly, one foot on the stairs, and his pocket watch open in his hand, like the rabbit in Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. Annabelle thought to jump into his arms and surprise him, as she had many times surprised her father, in thoughts that were not really dreams. But the watch gave her pause. She fancied she heard it ticking. "Oh, Mr. Pearson, where's mother?" "She's waiting for you, dear, in our new home, and wants us to get on the road right away." "She's not here?" Annabelle stopped on the stairs. Mr. Pearson stepped close to her, the banister between them. Bathed in the light from the landing window, his eyes were very blue. "Your mother misses you terribly and can't wait for you to join us. I've come for you, you see." Annabelle rushed past him out the front door to the porch. The street was empty. Only the porch swing trembled on its chains, for it always swayed when someone opened the door too fast. She had smelled her mother's scent below her, then above and before her. It was very curious. She reflected that the scent had weight, as the wind has weight or force to blow here and there. It had moved past her unaware, as though in a great hurry, not knowing her. Suddenly her head hurt very much, and she sat down in the empty porch swing. She felt him sit in the swing beside her. "Your mother has found you a very pretty pony," he said. "A pet for all of you, but yours to ride, I think, because he's no taller at the shoulder than this." And he touched the top of Annabelle's head. "Would you like to know the color of the pretty pony?" Annabelle felt him turn her face toward him and direct her gaze. "It is a white pony with a white mane and a black star just here." His hand was heavy on her head, and now he touched her forehead with his thumb. "Here, a black star." He pressed a warm circle on her flesh. The headache eased. She forgot it and felt drowsy, as though lifted from a hot bath. "Mother has gone," she said. "Our secret. Let the others be surprised." He stroked her brow. "About the pony." His eyes widened on hers. He swung them gently in the swing. Annabelle felt sleepy, smaller and younger. She looked down at her open hands in her lap. Her palms looked very white, like a drawing she saw from far away. "Now then," he said, and clapped once. "It's a lovely morning to travel." Annabelle wished the neighbors might see her on the porch with Mr. Pearson. He looked very nice in his suit, and less formal without his bow tie, his spectacles, and his jacket pocket. "We're going soon, then," Annabelle said. "Yes, indeed," he said. "Mr. Pearson, can I make a picnic? Yes, my dear, why don't you? What a good idea. Be quick about it. We have a long drive and shall leave in the cool of the day. And you may call me Cornelius, as your dear mother does. After all, we are not strangers, are we, dear? He stood from the swing and held the front door open for her as she flew through to the kitchen. She passed Greta standing on the stairs in grandmother's black lace dress, Mrs. Abernethy behind her, pulling tight the sash of her wrapper. We're going, Annabelle shouted. I'm making a picnic. Pearson has come back, and he sends Greta, the oldest girl, to the bank with a note requesting $1,000 from Asta Iger's account. She is not given the money because Asta Iger's account has $2.07 in it. Mr. Pearson was standing at the door as Greta came up the front steps. My dear, he said quietly. Greta thought it would be hard to tell him, but the words came easily. Mr. Pearson, they wouldn't give me the money. They said it was not my mother's writing. The signature, do you mean? How tiresome. Your mother won't be pleased, but never mind. Get the children. We'll leave immediately. Right now? I'll ask Mrs. Abernethy to help pack. No need. We'll be back for all that later. In any case, your mother has clothes for all of you in her trunk. She does? Greta had helped pack the trunk, her mother's best clothes, numerous mementos, but the note, my dear. She gave it to him gratefully and saw that Hart had come up behind them holding a plate of eggs and pancakes. Greta hasn't had breakfast, he said. Quite right. Give her that plate for the car. It's your second, isn't it? The picnic is in the back seat. Come along, Annabelle. He motioned her forward. I told Duty I will bring him back something special, Annabelle said, and send him messages. Dogs hear what we do not. She was holding her rag doll, Mrs. Pomeroy. They could hear Duty barking from the pantry. We'll be back soon enough, quickly now. Mr. Pearson widened his blue eyes at Hart and smiled. When we're far enough east, my boy, south into the beautiful hills, I shall give you a driving lesson. There's one stretch, seldom traveled, where the stream runs along beside the road. There you shall take the wheel, with my assistance. I'm going to drive? Oh, yes, a boy your age should know how to drive. Be quick now, get your cap. They were all out the door, into the car, rolling down the windows and remarking on the plush seats. Greta saw that Mr. Pearson, Cornelius, she must call him, was still in the house. Perhaps he'd forgotten the note. But then he was on the porch, down the steps, and they were all clapping and cheering. He turned the key, and the motor growled as the gears engaged. Hart wanted to blow the horn to tell the neighbors goodbye, but Cornelius drove them smoothly away. The journey was begun. There are very few moments in the book in which you're inside Powers' head. This is one of them. This leads into what I call the transition scene, which is in Annabelle's point of view. Later, near evening, the rain is drenching. He can barely see the turn onto the narrow dirt road. The children are asleep, lulled by the pounding rain. He slows the coupe, not to startle them, easing the car onto mud. For Quiet Dell Road is standing water and the creek along one side is nearly to its banks. The garage is near. He steers to the left side of the road and imagines the car afloat, riding the stream to Clarksburg. But he sees the garage, a simple hulk with a flat slant roof, intricate enough below ground. He will assure their sleep with the chloroform and rag in the glove box, open the garage door, and back the car inside. His blood is singing. He's entered that outer region in which it all begins. The penumbra around his head pulses like the charged gray emanation of a sunspot. He peers into a cloudiness in which flashes of brilliant red appear. Dutch royal purple, his father used to say. A beating well-deserved, the color of his backside, if not his face, for each time. For only a nest but Schmutzer, a diseased cur, shits in its own cage, betrays its own. Shanta, shanta, shanta. He feels a surge and grips the wheel, but the coupe slides to the right and halts, subtly tilted, the back right wheel in mud to the axle. The arcs of the headlights appear to fly into the downpour at a rakish angle. He leaves the engine engaged in essential vibration and applies the brake, the boy first, and when he's senseless, the girls, while he gets the boy inside, down the ladder to the cell. He takes the bottle of liquid from the glove box, grips the rag, inhales deeply not to be affected in the close interior of the car. He holds his breath in and begins. This immediately follows in Annabelle's point of view. A sick smell, prickly sweet, fists her shut until the car door opens like a bottom and drops her out. The sluice of water is on her face and all around her, for she's fallen into a lake, and someone pulls her roughly through long drowned grass that clings and tries to hold her. The car door slams. She gasps, swallowing rain. She's in his arms, crushed close. Where's Hart? Where's Greta? Inside, my dear, out of the rain. What is this place? One of my properties. I'm afraid you're carsick. Would you like to walk, or shall I carry you? This mud will ruin your shoes. He's nearly shouting over the rain, and she's dizzy, the downpour tumbling around her. She struggles to stand, and he keeps his hand upon her. Well, just wait where it's dry until I can rescue our automobile from the ditch. Annabelle sees the garage building through driving rain in the dark and knows about the basement rooms. It's like a shoebox cut in squares deep down inside where he was pounding, driving nails, making the walls thick and black. Stairs steep as a ladder go below. She sees it from above with the roof ripped off and the smell streaming out, a butcher shop smell pouring out like a pot boiling over. She sees the trap door standing open and Pearson pushing someone she can't see down the hole. She begins to run, dodging his hand, and he chases her, grabs her by her clothes as her shoes fly off in the mud. He hits her so hard that she flies back against the car. There's a shattering inside her, glass flying apart, splinters too small to count. She sees then from above, Pearson stuffing her muddy shoes in his pocket. She herself moves easily, high above him, as though a string of yarn unwinding from a skein might connect her to that other girl below. She sees that she's wearing her grandmother's slippers, but they fit perfectly and are no longer worn, but look new. They shine and bear her up. There's no rain here, though she sees the rain, a shifting downward mass of transparent color. She finds herself in some new element, moving as a swimmer might tread water, and rises further still. She thinks to call for her mother, but knows her mother's not here. Greta and Hart, though, perhaps are here. She sees Pearson, dark, hunched and wet, a furry, swollen spider, sidled here and there by the mud that rises and ridges when he tries to pass. He pulls a girl by her bound hands. That is not she, Annabelle knows, for she is looking down at him. She can see the bright rain and smell the mud, clinging to itself like the mercury that fell out of grandmother's broken thermometer. Rain floods the muddy clearing and dense green woods, separating and running in rivulets, tossing and stirring and dredging up the ground that is black and thick as chocolate. Then she's on the road with Pearson before her. She moves toward him, trying to reach the girl to slide her from him. But there's only a trace of motion when she moves her hand, a shimmer. And Annabelle sees across the road her rag doll, Mrs. Pomeroy, in wet mud beside the car, where she fell when Pearson pulled Annabelle out, for the doll had been her pillow. Annabelle must have her. She moves close in a terrible slow drift, but cannot grasp the belted dress or fabric face. Her hand disappears in what she sees. She thinks about the inside of the car, somewhere dry and safe, and sees Mrs. Pomeroy wedged deep into the fold of the back seat. His hand will not find her. She's only caught in batting, crushed and squeezed, so small. The golden cord about her waist is grandmother's golden cord, the cord that binds one soul to another. Annabelle sees the cord then, longer, thicker, shining, tied to a rafter, for she's inside the dim garage. Rain hammers the roof. A long trap door lies flung open and rough wooden steps disappear into the dark below. Annabelle touches the cord and feels instead her grandmother's silken hand reaching for her as though across a great distance. The air around her swells and brightens. Her own grandmother is here, clear and luminous. She has only to move her arm and beckon to pull Annabelle near and lift them up, high and higher, above the hulk of the building, the muddy road, the rain. Annabelle sees forests and meadows, green swaths and deep valleys, half lit in sunlight, shading darkest near the garage and its hidden rooms. She hears the meadow creatures and their sounds, clicks and whirs of song and flight, rise and flow all around her, so distinctly, though she is high above. The dark is gone. Now, after the family disappears, the alarm is finally raised in Chicago, and a local banker funds, this all happened in reality, funds detectives from Park Ridge who fly to Clarksburg to try to identify the man they know as Cornelius Pearson, who is known in Clarksburg as Harry Powers. Park Ridge is a very chic place, and it was so even then, and the town is concerned that the yellow press will take advantage of the family, will not respect them in its coverage. And so a certain female reporter from the Chicago Tribune is engaged to go to Quiet Dell and cover the story for the Tribune and the Illinois papers. Her name is Emily Thornhill. And they know that the bodies have been found outside Quiet Dell. In fact, the cover of the book, this is one of the photographs taken by a wonderful photographer who later took, or I guess it was his son who took our school pictures. They had a photography business, Ideal Sayre Studios. You remember that name, some of you do. Anyway, this picture was taken as the bodies had already been exhumed, the first four bodies, Asta and her three children. And it looks like almost a religious gathering in the woods. People are wearing their best clothes. They seem to be gathered for some intense purpose. And in fact, that's what this photograph is. A fifth body was discovered later, that of a grass widow from Massachusetts. Do you know what a grass widow is? A divorced woman, which is very scandalous at the time. But Emily Thornhill, knowing that the bodies have been found, has driven all night from Chicago with a colleague, and they're just arriving at Quiet Dell, and they're pulling into what was really just a garage building and a dirt driveway. Emily breathed in, oh, and one other thing, the dog, as you remember, Duty, was locked in the pantry. And when Emily goes to the Eichers' home, the nurse is there with the dog. She picks up the dog and sees that it has a scar right here in its throat. And she intuits that, Abernathy tells her that as Pearson left the house, the dog got out of the pantry somehow, this very heavy pantry door, and raced for the door. And she has an intuition that, you know, this scar looks like it's just the foot, the toe of someone's boot. And he kicked the dog so hard that he crushed its larynx. And the dog's no longer able to bark. But Emily says to herself, A, the dog has no one. And B, he's a material witness. And she has this idea to take the dog with her and confront Powers, a scene that does come to pass. Anyway, she's got the dog, and she becomes rather fond of the dog, just as she becomes very, very invested in the case, particularly in Annabelle, a child she sees as being special. Okay. Emily breathed in the crushed green smells of earth, wild mustard, honeysuckle, and then a darker scent. They pulled carefully onto an open dirt road before the garage, which was rude and small, square, flat-roofed, with wooden doors in front. The crowd, perhaps 200 or more, stood quietly. All looked toward the back of the building. Emily heard then the pounding of pickaxes and the slough of dirt shoveled and thrown. The smell was the ditch uncovered. They're gone now, she told herself. They are not here, not even their bodies. But the men were still digging, and the crowd was waiting. A quiet restlessness moved among them. Few spoke, and only in lowered voices. The ditch, a deep gash, ran straight some 40 or 50 feet from the garage to the back of the lot. Duty struggled forward on the leash, dragging Emily to the very edge of the ditch. It seemed he might jump in, and the thought horrified her. The ditch was muddy and wet, for it opened into a little creek, whose dark green water lay nearly still, barely visible through towering weeds, scrub trees, and purple stalky blooms taller than the men who stood near them. Was that Queen Anne's lace grown to such a height? The white flowers were the size of parasols. A smaller ditch, the uncovered gas line, bisected the large one. The two indentions formed a shape very like a cross that emptied into the water. Emily turned, pulling the dog with her, peering past the disturbed ground as far as the horizon. The creek looked no more than 15 feet across, and she could see the water move, a glowing lip against the opposite shore and gently ascending meadow. Heavy-limbed trees stood silhouetted in the field, their canopies stirring. The sky was pale blue against the darker earth, and the creek seemed to mark a line between one world and another. She imagined walking across the water, leading Duty on the leash to that other empty meadow that lay bathed in the softest, pearlized light. But none of them on this side were worthy of that place. So again, this, here's the creek, and here is the meadow. Okay, I'm going to end the reading with one very short section from Annabelle's point of view. Annabelle can dream when she's awake and waken in her sleep, or she is never asleep, but always dreaming. She moves above or through the urgency of people moving and doing. She turns away at will and bridges great distances in the breadth of a thought. She's here, in the place grandmother called below. Narrow dirt roads thread through the mountains. Drawn closer, she sees throngs of people crowded near the hunched garage. Lines of metal glint in angled curves, the tops of many black cars. The glass of the windscreen sparkles, catches the sun. She sees a long, bright car that pulls up last. A woman gets out with Duty on the leash. Annabelle hears the click of the leash moving and smells the trampled grass, dung and earth, and so many shoes and boots and mingled bodies. She knows she smells what Duty smells. She cannot feel the weight of him or the warmth, but senses him intensely, for nothing separates her now from those for whom she longs so deeply. Duty turns his head, confused. His long, mournful search is over. He has found them. Emily stands beside the dark slash in the ground. Duty smells some remnant mixed in the earth and pulls her to the dirt edge of the gash. He would leap into the dark, roll in it, and taste it, as with dead things at home, a squashed bird, a rabbit torn by cats. Annabelle waits in the meadow across the creek. There is no death here, no danger. Birds take wing like glimmers, rising up. Rabbits wear their closed wounds like flowers. She knows the gash across the creek is dense and black, deepening, tugging at the crouched garage. The people standing near are quiet, as though gathered for a meeting of great import. Across the way, light flashes from the roof of the garage like an eye that opens while the ground is sifted and pulled. Deep in the gash, a glow begins. They have found something. They murmur that something is found. Annabelle hears Duty barking as he used to bark at home. The crowd is shifting and moving, and she sees Duty pull Emily toward her, straining at the leash. Thank you. Because, of course, the dog can see her. Okay.